Well, now, Eliphaz strictures in the earlier chapters four and five fall on deaf ears. The so-called friend is determined that Job is suffering for sin. And we know from God, chapters 1 and 2, we know from God that that is not so. That it is the very opposite of the truth. Job is not suffering for sins, but on account of his righteousness. Whereas Job is much more concerned about his suffering than about the cause of it, although he knows in his heart that all this calamity has come upon him quite unbidden, as far as his righteous soul knows. He has said rash things, of course, which he knows he has said, and to that extent he accepts Eliphaz's rebuke. Yes, he has said rash things, but he's sorry. But no one knows the weight of his woe. His woe, it is a pantechnicon of woes, a whole world of anguish and agony, to be weighed almost in cosmological terms. A universe of woe, heavier than the sands and the seashore. Wasn't that striking? And it is from God, he believes. Well, he knows that the trouble has not come upon him without God's knowledge and God's permission, at least. But whether it has come to him by God's purposive will, that he does not know. But that God is in it, that's for sure. And so he proceeds to certain proofs in answer to Eliphaz. There's a reason for everything, verse 5. Chapter 6, verse 5. There's a reason for everything. The beasts don't bray and bellow for nothing, and the call for salt to season an egg is not without its reason, verse 6, in the tastelessness of the white of an egg. Of course, food is primarily to nourish our bodies, but we would not be so keen on it if we did not find pleasure in making food palatable, would we? And there's a reason for Job's crying out, verse 8. He wants God to do something about his suffering. He doesn't want, of course, to impugn the Almighty, the Holy One, far from that. But something must be done. His situation is desperate, so desperate that if there is to be no cure, then at least God might crush him and put an end to his misery. If God would accede to that simple request in his throes, then he would willingly die without saying a word against the Holy One, verse 10, and that would afford him a certain satisfaction that even in his trouble he had not been ungodly or godless and spoken against his Maker. And if Job's friends wonder why he is so desperate and hopeless, they must simply ask the question, verse 11, what strength or hope or prospects has he lying here in such a mess of corruption and misery? After all, he's not stone or metal, which has apparently no feeling in it at all. What can I do in my plight, he says, when everything I have lived for is taken away, even comfort, ease, and health? Surely you fellows, verse 14, surely you fellows see what I am suffering. And if so, do I not have your understanding, sympathy? Even if God Almighty has forsaken me for some unknown reason, surely my friends will not prove unfaithful. like undependable streams which come and go at will without rhyme or reason. And so Job plunges into a long discussion of the intermittence of nature and man, and the inconsistency of flowing water when it is turned to ice, and then with the heat it flows again, and those seeking an oasis may be disappointed. The water is frozen, or it is dried up. Or, he says, verse 18, it is like caravans of travelers looking for water to slake their thirst and that of their animals, and they arrive at a watering place or some oasis and find nothing. It's not, he says at verse 21, that I have come to you for help and found you useless, but that you have come to me apparently to help me. And what help are you to me? My plight is so great that it obviously baffles you completely, and you are not able to say or do anything at all to help me. I'm not asking for pecuniary help, he says in verse 22, or for support against enemies, verse 23. It is something much more personal than that I am seeking. If you think, he says, verse 24, I have something to learn in this great calamity which has befallen me, then show me, even if the words are painful, and I have to be humiliated. But up to now, what have you said? Eliphaz, verse 25. What have you said which matches my desperate need? You have looked at my condition and have formed your own ideas of the cause, and you have not listened to a word I have said. How like human nature that is, isn't it? And one of the greatest lessons we have to learn in caring for each other is not to jump to conclusions, but really to open our minds and listen to what the sufferer is really saying. This the psychologists and the psychiatrists call non-directive counseling. And there's a great deal to it. And many who have found themselves in such people's hands have been astonished to discover that whether such people, such professionals, have been able to help them or not, they were really willing to listen. But there's nothing of that with you, Eliphaz. You simply listen so that you may correct what I say, because you regard the words of my mouth, desperate as I am, as wind, if you please. Indeed, the ruthlessness of your own self-opinion is so strong that you would go to all lengths to support your word, even to gamble away fatherless children and barter your friend to be proved right. And such talk, you see, reminds us, especially those of us who were here this morning and earlier on Sunday morning, reminds us of Joseph's brethren selling their brother into slavery for 20 shekels of silver. Kenneth Kitchen says that was the current price of a slave in patriarchal times. And Leviticus 27:5 says it was the value of an able-bodied man. What an attitude, Eliphaz, to have to a man in such anguish as I am. And so Job ends his word by a pathetic appeal. Won't you be so kind, he says at verse 28, to look at me? Would a man in my condition lie to your face and preserve an elaborately staged deception of you? You must relent and give up the injustice of your cruel remarks and outrageous insinuations and reconsider my case, for it is nothing less than my integrity which is at stake, my righteousness, my vindication. And so the chapter ends, verse 30. Where can you find wickedness on my lips? Desperate and impetuous and rash as I may have been in my appalling state, Do you think my taste, my palate, is so perverted that I cannot perceive what is perverse and vicious and malicious? In any case, he says, plunging into another chapter of reaction to Eliphaz, chapter 7, verse 1, does not man have hard labor on the earth? Is his life not a slavery, he says? Well, Job, we wonder if you would have said that a year ago before you were afflicted. But we must admit that in your awful plight, without any reasonable prospect of betterment, we can understand your feeling. Well, he would say, speaking out of the dunghill, the Golgotha of his crucifixion, he would say, I'm like a slave, verse 2, longing for the end of the day, or a laborer for his wages, with no prospect ahead of him, possibly for ages, but the futility of this terrible life and this misery of nights. As night drags on, he says, I long for the morning and toss all night, and my body, look at it, he says, verse 5, look at my body, it's covered with scabs and clothed with worms, my skin a festering mass of sores. And then in verse 6, on the other hand, the meaninglessness of my days is as the swiftness of the weaver's shuttle. They come and go and pass as if they were nothing, with nothing accomplished and absolutely nothing to look forward to. And then he turns to God, as in complete despair of ever having any help or comfort from this man Eliphaz or any of these three friends. And so he turns the seventh chapter into a kind of soliloquy to God, as if these men were simply not there. Remember me, O God, remember me, whose life is but a puff of wind, which is soon gone forever, so that my eyes will never see any good. I'll soon be gone, and people will look for Job and say, where is he? But he will have gone like a cloud from the sky, as if it had never been. That's how I'll go down to the grave, to Sheol, he says in verse 10, the abode of the dead, and no house or home will ever see me again. This being so, O Lord, he says, I refuse to keep silent. This is my last chance. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit and complain in the bitterness of my soul. What am I? Am I an ocean or a sea monster threshing about in the sea that you keep me under guard and watch to plague me night and day? Ah, notice these words, verse 12. Here's a hint, just a hint, that over against Job's complaint to his God, he is sensing or seeing at last, discerning a little, somehow or another, an evil element in his suffering. You remember, of course, that Eliphaz described a nightmare that he had, thinking it was God. Whereas you may remember that I said I was sure that it was demonic. Well, what's this in chapter 7, verses 13 and 14? Job lying in bed. Bed. What kind of a bed could it be with his body in that mess? When I try to find a lair to the comfort or easement of my suffering, you frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I would prefer strangling, he says in verse 15, violent death rather than to continue to endure this putrid, suppurating carcass of mine. Is it not natural then, he says, verse 16, for me to despise my life and not to wish to prolong it any longer? Certainly the thought that I might live thus forever would drive me mad. For goodness sake, he says, speaking to the Lord, leave me alone, God in heaven. Why do you torment me? and my meaningless life. In any case, verse 17, what is man that on the one hand you make so much of him, constantly examining him every moment of the day so that you never leave him alone, but on the other it never seems to be an examination toward betterment, but always to find out my sin, you watcher of men, he calls God. Verse 20, why do you make me such an odious target? Do you never get tired, O God, wearing me down? And why do you not pardon my offenses if I have been such a sinner? And why don't you blot out my sin from your remembrance? After all, I shall soon be laid completely in the dust, and you will search for me in vain, because I shall be no more. Well, Job, that's quite a rash of statements, some of them obviously contradictory. But we do understand to some extent your desperate condition. We read of it in the first chapters. And we're trying to allow something for your great suffering. But let's see what the second of the three friends is going to say, because he is clearly waiting to speak, Bildad. And he starts in quite harshly. How long will you say such things and bluster like the wind? Does God pervert justice? Does he pervert what is right? And then, having put in the knife, he turns it most viciously. You remember that his children, all his children, perished in a hurricane when the hurricane blew down the house and they all died. He says it was your children's sin that gained them the penalty of death. Nothing that you could say to a father could be more painful than that. Could anything have been so hurtful? And so you say to yourself, Bildad, what kind of a character is this Bildad? Even if he thought what he has said, would you think him to be so devoid of sensitivity as to come out with it plump and plain, without a care for how it would add to the poor man's hurt and suffering? It's incredible. And especially when it's untrue. Cruel and untrue. And then this Bildad proceeds to preach the gospel to him. And again it is a word utterly inappropriate to the person and to the occasion. We discussed that last week. Preaching an inappropriate gospel to a people that it doesn't apply to. Utterly inappropriate to Job and to the occasion. Because Bildad is virtually saying everything has gone wrong with you because you and your lot are gross sinners. If you repent and turn to God, he will soon make things right for you, Job. And of course you see the drift of this, chapter 8, verses 5-7. He says, but if you will look to God and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your rightful place. Your beginnings will seem humble, so prosperous will your future be. Now I told you last Sunday evening of the woman who came to us many years ago to escape a flaming evangelist who for long had tried to get her to repent and believe the gospel, because she did not use all his gospel cliches. And so he did not think she was a Christian at all. She was certainly an eccentric lady. But we found in the fellowship here that she truly loved the Lord and had need of him because of the tragic events of her life. But between the suicide of her husband and the cruelest circumstances, and this man trying to deny that she had any evangelical faith, she soon needed hospital treatment and died in virtual insanity. You see, this misplaced zeal And misapplication of the gospel is something which young Christians who have emerged, say, from non-Christian homes would need to be very careful about. You may find that parents, and even more so grandparents today, who have lived their lives so long without any personal knowledge of Jesus Christ, unless, of course, he comes to them in an extraordinary fashion and really transforms them outside in. But if they have had no personal knowledge of Jesus Christ, they may never, in the remaining days of their life, they may never get accustomed to the language of Zion. And so someone charges them with not being Christians because they can't rattle off all the gospel cliches. We ought to test people's lives rather than their fumbling words when they've not much experience of Scripture or the gospel. We should be looking for the slightest signs of their relenting their opposition to the faith, and looking for those incipient signs of grace in their behavior. I can think of someone who began to show signs of grace and was constantly in place in church until in old age the mind began to go, and then hints of former bad language began to resurface and pour out from this poor man's mind, and his wife began to despair and wring her hands after many years of prayer for him. But she had to be told. This was Satan invading a demented mind. And the hospitals are full of such people. Lovely Christians. Satan invading a demented mind. And it was necessary to refuse to believe that a work of grace had not been done in that man's heart. Thinking of that wonderful lesson that Ian Ferguson gave us on Wednesday about dealing with needy souls at West Hill, one thought, what discernment we need in dealing with people to understand human nature. However, Bildad then tries contempt. "You transient creature of a day," he says to the poor sufferer, "whose life is but a shadow on the earth, you ought to apply yourself to the ageless wisdom of the past that our forefathers searched out, and let that inform and instruct you. You remind me," he says, "of the papyrus which grows so proudly in the marshes. Watch it when the waters fail, how quickly it withers, quicker than grass. It grows so proudly in the marshes, but when the waters fail, it withers. Such," he says, "cruelly is the destiny of those who forget God. Their hope is gone. Their hold on life is so fragile that it is like a spider's web that someone leans on, and it is gone." And really, you know, as one reads these words by Bildad, having already read God's estimate of Job in the first two chapters of the book, it is hardly credible that any man could be so harshly insensitive and so misguided as this Bildad. The ignorance of the man is one thing, but the ruthlessness of his misapplication of his self-righteous comments is quite another, isn't it? And so we need to pause in a sense for breath before we go on to the rest of the chapter. Glad that it is one of the shorter ones, for it's so horrible when we know something about Job. And so as I first read through this chapter, I thought, oh, how much more of this have we to endure? At verse 16, Bildad seems to be harking back to Job's better days when he prospered, and he's attributing to him a great pride in his own achievements, spreading himself in the garden of life like a well-watered climbing plant in the sunshine. But someone comes and pulls it up by the roots, and look at it now, even hours after it has been wrenched from his bed in the soil. It's a heap of ruins, and in a day or two, you'd hardly see its shores. And soon, other plants replace it, as if it had never been there. I sometimes think, walking round certain parts of the city, how younger folk will never know some of the quaintness of ancient Aberdeen that has been swiped away with concrete. How horrid, isn't it? But Bildad concludes at last, unctuously, oilily, the soul of piety. Well, now, don't you see how religious people can be when they're condemning others? Oh, the unctuous religiosity of those who are forever looking down their noses and pointing their finger and accusing other people. Oh, how religious they are. Have you noticed? Sure. As God doesn't reject a blameless man. God had called Job blameless, not sinless, but blameless. Surely God doesn't reject a blameless man or strengthen the hands of evildoers. And of course there is the implication here. Job, you must be a very bad man to have suffered so much. But then Bildad's self-righteousness and his delight at being able to pronounce judgment on poor Job leads him to be very magnanimous in the end. Magnanimous to Job's prospect if he repents. The man, Bildad, is the soul of self-satisfaction and of overheated hypocrisy. God, he says, will yet fill your mouth with laughter, Job, when you have come to your senses and have acknowledged your sin. Your lips will yet shout for the joy of forgiveness and restoration. Listen, Job, the man of God is talking. Take it in, Job. These are my words of wisdom to a guilty sinner. Then, if you listen and act, your enemies will be clothed in shame, and the tents of the wicked will be no more. Now, this last verse is interesting. It suggests that it is Job's errors and faults which have allowed the onrush of his enemies. But it is not clear what that may mean. Who are Job's enemies? Does the man mean the Sabaeans who put Job's servants to the sword? Chapter 1, verse 15. Or is he referring to the Chaldeans who did the same and carried off his flocks and herds? Chapter 1, verse 17. For you see, it was, as I said earlier, it was the hurricane which destroyed Job's family when the house in which they were feasting was blown down. But Bildad is not attributing to nature, nor would I think to demonic forces, the destruction of his family and livestock. Yet what does he mean about enemies? Actually, if the man knew it, he is one of Job's enemies, who has come, alas, to add to his torments by accusation. Ironically, you know, if we were to refer to the end of the book of Job, we would see that these three characters were regarded by the Lord as sufficiently Job's enemies for them to be roundly rebuked by the Lord for not speaking what was right as far as Job was concerned. But self-righteous Bildad would not see that, of course. He's blind to that. And the amazing thing is that If we peep into chapter 9, which we'll do, God willing, next Sunday evening, if we peep into chapter 9, we see that Job, instead of exploding, this is the grace of the man, instead of exploding at this man's speech, at all the broad innuendos and direct accusations Bildad has leveled against him, he simply continues the doctrinal question of how a man can be justified in God's sight. And we'll look at that in due course. But of course, in these three chapters, we have plenty to be going on with now. All right then, Job has sounded in chapters 6 and 7 a whole range of complaints and has given ample scope for oncoming friends to attack him. He has made himself so vulnerable, Job. One thing about him that one sees that one had not seen before is that he really is a very naive man, naive in the best sense. Innocent, I would almost use that word. We have before us in our three chapters two astonishing manifestations. One, the simple naivety of suffering Job to let fly with his tongue and not expect anyone listening to him to react accusingly. Some pious souls won't allow us ever to be angry or say an angry word. Is that possible in this evil world? The dear man, in all his innocence, simply let fly. Do you follow me in this? Here's a man, I believe, who is as innocent as the day and has none of the subtlety of the night about him at all. No darkness in him. He has lived an altogether upright life, and the Lord has prospered him, and it didn't turn his head. As indeed, when we come to them, chapters 29 to 31, especially 31, makes it plain, testify to the fact that all God's prosperity to Job did not turn its head, and that's something to say of those who are prospered, that their wealth does not turn their heads. The more God blessed Job, and thank God there are such people, the more God blessed Job, the more he cared for the needy. That's what he's talking about in chapter 31. You might read that before you sleep tonight. It's a beautiful chapter. So here's a man who has lived so far from the subtleties of evil that in his distress he cries out like an innocent child. And not understanding what God is now doing to him, is quite innocently free with his remarks about God. And alas, these undiscerning friends are completely shocked. And assume, of course, that a man lashing out as Job has done in the midst of his dunghill situation must be a thoroughly bad lot. Now, you may think I exaggerate Job's innocent purity as a man of the world with a grown-up family, and prosperous at that. But just read again what the Lord has said about Job. You know, I don't think you will find in the Bible a recommendation by God of any man, Old Testament or New Testament, like what God says about Job. Listen. God says this about a man who, of course, like all of us, is a sinner. Saved by grace, undoubtedly, no doubt about that, but a sinner. God says, there is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright a man who fears God and shuns evil. You never read a description of a man like that in the Bible, our blessed Lord apart, of course. Never. You don't hear that description of a man in the New Testament, do you? Even the holy apostles? Never. He is a rare, if not a unique, specimen. Now, I used the word innocent of him a moment ago, but that's not the word. One uses the word innocent or innocence, or I would, for Adam before the fall. Innocent, not tried, not tested. But the word for Job, a sinner saved by grace and by the operation of faith to the extent that Almighty God commends him so highly, the word for Job is virtuous. Virtuous, if not holy. But you see, he has eschewed, he has shunned and avoided so much evil in his lifetime that he has happily so little personal, notice what I say, so little personal knowledge of evil that he might be in danger of regarding other men as transparent as himself. But they're not. They're not, far from it. Hence, Job is not worldly enough. Job is not subtle enough to hide his anguished feelings from these men. And he would have assumed that they would well understand why he cried out in astonishment and bewilderment at his agonies. But they did not. And being these three, at best, men of legalistic ethics, legalistic morals, knowing little of mercy and grace, although they talk a lot about God forgiving Job if he repents, they come down on the poor fellow like a ton of bricks and are soon condemning him roundly, every one of them, as Bildad has just done. And I believe that this man Job has lived a life of such grace, well, God has said so, that when adversity came upon him, having so little personal knowledge of evil, and having a great horror of it, remember, in his family, when it comes upon him, he explodes as if this is something which should never have come to him. Now, do you see what I'm trying to say? I don't think I have ever sought to work out the nature of Job's righteousness, but have simply accepted it as a fact, because God said it. All right. But the nature of Job's righteousness is something which, as we proceed through these chapters, we may have to inquire into more. And I shall be doing so during the weeks. But perhaps the nature of Job's righteousness, which has taken such a knock when he is afflicted, can be better brought out in contrast with these other three fellows. We've only had two so far, but that's enough to see their drift pointing towards an accusation, a simple, clear accusation of Job as suffering for his sins, whereas God has already said he is suffering for his righteousness. Suffering for his righteousness to show to Job himself, first of all, and to us, that the quality of faith God gives to his own can withstand all hell let loose upon them. That's what God's trying to show here. Do you believe that? Their idea of faith, these three, their idea of faith is that it should lead to a life such as Job lived before he was afflicted, of peace, prosperity, and magnanimity to the needy. But that there was an enemy who would try God's saint until Satan did his damnedest in the hope of shaking him. That would never have entered into their heads. And Job didn't know it either. This is what they thought. Evil was in man, particularly this fellow Job. Perhaps they thought that evil was not all that bad, except when a man like Job came along in such a hideous state that one began to wonder if he had plumbed a depth of evil not common to men. Even then, they would not see evil as of demonic or satanic proportions. That's clear from the fact that Eliphaz, you remember, chapter 4, verses 12 to 16, had a nightmare, and he attributed it to God, because while he had some concept of evil, we're not denying that, while Eliphaz and the others had some concept of evil, the last thing in the world they would ever dream of doing is putting a D on at the beginning of that word. No concept of a personal devil at all. And that's exactly what is lacking in so many religious and Christian and evangelical people today. The old G.T. Thompson, who used to be professor of theology in Aberdeen, George Paget Thompson, used to say that a religion without a hell, and of course he meant a devil too, a religion without a hell wasn't worth a damn. And I think that's what I'm wrestling with here, and I hope you are too. That's the point of dealing with this book. Neither Job nor his three friends have an adequate conception of evil and can't see a personal devil at all. There's just God, who is holy, and men who are bad. Job is attributing the evil he is suffering to God, and he can't understand it because he loved God. And the three friends are attributing it to Job. And they certainly fail to understand him. Both of them are wrong. The one and the three. But whereas Job's wrong is that of astonishment and ignorance, the three friends' attitude is one of plain accusation. Evil is in man, and particularly in this fellow. So you see, both Job and the three friends are deeply at fault, because neither the one nor the three believe in the devil. And therefore, their concept of what can happen to man on the earth is entirely inadequate. Oh, can you see that? And on this old earth, with all its wrong, to have a religion without a devil is not sufficient to understand even a storm in a teacup. I'm going to read now, as I draw to a close, an article that appeared in the Times yesterday morning by one Anthony Phillips, headmaster of the King's School, Canterbury. And it's entitled, The Shadow Side of God. He says, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God is person. There should then be no surprise that from time to time the believer must experience that shadow side, which is a necessary part of all personality. Yet, he says, far too often believers think of God as both readily available and entirely beneficent, attributing any apparent hostility to their sins. This, he says, is not the biblical picture. there is a dark side to God, he says, of which no man should be ignorant. There are terms here that I object to, but I see what the man is trying to say. And perhaps I could sum it up before I read any more and saying, he says some good things, mentions Job, but there's no devil in it. No devil. And to that extent, this scholar is as blind as a bat. This is not the biblical picture, he says. There is a dark side to God which no man should be, of which no man should be. Listen to these horrid words. At his whim and without good cause, God persists in testing men who can only echo the psalmist's cry, why? How long? Only through endurance of what is both inexplicable and unjustified can the believer know God's presence again. He's really attributing evil to God in a most paradoxical fashion. So Abraham was bidden by God to sacrifice the child of promise. He knew full well that he would have no further children at his age. Throughout that incomprehensible journey to Mount Moriah, God remained darkly silent. Isaac was laid on the altar his father had made. Conscious of the indefensible nature of his situation, I don't like that word, indefensible, conscious of the indefensible nature of his situation, Abraham acts. He is prepared to nullify the promise, because only by relying on the God whose presence he has so richly enjoyed could he make sense of his absence now. Abraham raises the knife, not in blind despair, but as a positive act made in the face of every claim upon him, national, ethical, and religious. Only then does God speak. A ram is provided instead. Job too, he says, faces God's shadow side. As deprived of possessions, children, and health, he is counseled by his wife to curse God and die, that is, commit suicide. For the Hebrews believed that God would strike the blasphemer dead. But Job calls her a fool. She does not realize that, as with all personal relationships, and all the more so those that are particularly intimate, the darkness of the other has to be endured in order that there may again be knowledge. Confronted by an apparently malevolent God, I would admit that apparently malevolent God who appears as his enemy, Job at no point admits the validity of his suffering. So he is richly rewarded, for unlike the friends, he refused either to reject his belief in God or to deny his own integrity. That the dark side of God is present within the Trinity, he says, itself, the Passion narrative makes plain. Now you see, in one sense that is true, but in another sense, that is an appalling untruth. For the darkness is due to evil and the devil, isn't it? In Jesus' hideous cry from the cross, his affirmation of belief in his Father, my God, is placed alongside the acknowledgement of his God-forsaken state. Why hast thou forsaken me? The responsibility for his death is placed firmly on God's shoulders. Only when Jesus has breathed his last does God choose to make himself known again. The veil of the temple is torn in two. Whether he says it was as pilgrims in the desert or as the psalmist struggling to profess belief, the Hebrews recognized that it was no part of faith to defend the indefensible, to pretend that God is other than person with the dark consequences that entailed. for us, person, the believer, will be subject to his irrational enmity. He speaks of the irrational enmity of God, as well as his all-embracing, life-giving love. But the latter, the love, can only be enjoyed through the persistent worship of the very God who not only chooses to hide himself in sullen blankness when he is most needed, but appears to will himself the enemy in unprovoked and all-consuming hostility. And this worship can be no passive affair. Rather, it is a necessary condition of prayer, that it must involve a total commitment of the self, like Jacob. A commitment of the self, like Jacob, a wrestling with God until one receives his blessing, even with a God who will not wrestle. And then he goes on, without such courage, persistence, and abandonment, there can be no answer. Faced with the unpleasant facts of life, the worshipper has no choice but to challenge God. And then in face of both silence and hostility, sweat it out. For the only faith worth having is a faith which takes into account both the reality of God whose love one can experience and the reality of the life in a world in which the absence of that love can also be experienced. Faced with the shadow side of God, the believer must challenge the very morality of the God he wills to affirm. Caught in a hopeless situation about which he may not believe that God can or will do anything, he should still confront God with the facts. For it is in his faithful impotence amid the inconsistencies, confusions, and resentments, which are the stuff of all relationships, that the believer manifests God's power. And it is in such passion that God's rule is realized. Now, that's involved. But you see, what the man is saying, that is simply that we must see the dark side as belonging to God, because there ain't a devil. Isn't it sad? Isn't that infinitely sad? But you see, when God made man on the pattern of the one ultimate man, Jesus Christ, he made him and designed to furnish him with such a quality of faith that he would be able to withstand all the assaults of hell and never give in. And this is what Ian Ferguson was illustrating for us on Wednesday from Hebrews chapter 11 and from the experience of his recently formed church in West Hills. Ian read these verses. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32. Well-known verses. Hebrews 11 and 32. And what more shall I say? I do not have time, says the writer, to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith. Yet none of them received what has been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. And you know, the interesting thing about the list of the heroes of faith in the Old Testament in Hebrews chapter 11 does not include Job. And that I do not understand. Does not include Job. Ah, but it takes the next book in the Bible. You know what that is? The letter of James. It takes the next book in the Bible, written by our Lord's own natural half-brother, James, to exclaim, after he has instanced the examples of the prophets of the Lord, to exclaim, "You have heard of the patient perseverance of Job." And the amazing thing is this, and this I think is new to me, that without the knowledge of Satan, and thinking that for some absolutely inexplicable reason, God is afflicting him, this is what this man is saying, you see. Without the knowledge of Satan, and thinking that for some absolutely inexplicable reason, God is afflicting him, Job remains true to God, even when he thinks God has turned into a hostile monster. That's why he says in chapter 13, that we'll come to in due course, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." You can't have a greater faith than that. Only if Job had known about the devil at the beginning of his trial, as he did at the end, he would never have said the things to God that he did. But he didn't. Even so, God forgave him, because his faith in God held to a point worse than death, that of excruciating agony, an agony that would not go away until God revealed to Job what all this was in aid of. Then Job understood. But you see, faith had held on without understanding. And this is the wonderful thing, that we see in Christians with broken hearts, many broken hearts these days. We see in Christians with broken hearts that without understanding what has happened to them, and even tempted sometimes to malign the very name of God, they continue to trust in him and will never let him go. That's tremendous, don't you think? Tremendous. As we were saying last night at prayer, faith is something, once God has planted it in our breasts and it has taken root, faith is something that you cannot lose. You cannot lose true faith, which is the gift of God, because it belongs to God. And when he has cast his anchor into our souls and claimed us for his own, nothing can happen to us, though all hell be let loose against us and all men hate us, because we belong to him. And he will see us through.